Hey guys, welcome back to Real Time Crime.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Jedi, and I'm so excited to be back with our second holiday story for the month of December. And today's episode is on Joanna Yates. So take it away, Hannah.
So today's episode is covering the story of Joanna Yates. She was a woman who went missing on December 17th in 2010, and her body was found 8 days later on Christmas morning. This takes place in Bristol, England, which is about 2.5 hours west of London, and it's relatively close to Bath. So Joanna Yates was 25 years old at the time. She's described as someone who's just full of life and energy, just very confident, always reassuring others, saying things like, it's going to be all right, it'll be okay, you know, that kind of a person. She was a recent graduate with a degree in architectural landscape, like a doctorate in it. She had a boyfriend. His name was Greg Reardon. He's 27 at the time, and they had met while working at the same firm, when they met, they were living in a different city, and then the firm moved to Bristol, so they moved with it. After a while, he ended up working for a different firm, still in the same town, and they shared an apartment together. And they were just described to be a very like young, enthusiastic couple, excited to just be living together and creating a home together. So the apartment that they lived in was a converted Victorian house that had 8 apartments in it. This was in a residential area. A lot of the buildings nearby were similar sized homes that were converted apartment buildings. There was like a really big green space off to one of the sides of their block. And then maybe like 30, 40 feet behind the building, there was a parking lot for another apartment building. So it wasn't uncommon for like some foot traffic from time to time. And they lived, Joanna and her boyfriend, Greg, lived in one of the 2 basement apartments. The basement apartments were accessible from side paths on opposite sides of the building. And then the other 6 apartments were accessible through like the main entrance of the house. So the landlord, his name is Christopher Jeffries, and he lived in the apartment directly above Joanna and Greg. He was 65 at the time, a retired English teacher, never married, so he lived alone. And he just was very quiet and reserved. And he just liked to read his books. He didn't even own a TV. He was described as being very well-spoken and like very matter-of-fact kind of guy. And he just seemed a bit odd to everyone around in the area because he seemed to act a bit more upper class in what's described as a more middle-class area. But yeah, nothing odd about him. In the other basement apartment was their neighbor, Vincent Tabak, and his girlfriend, Tanya. Vincent was 33 at the time. He's from a small town in Holland. He's the youngest of 5. He got a PhD there. He worked as a people flow analyst, I believe is what it was called. So he would consult about where to place security cameras and things to help with the flow of people in public areas. So yeah, he got his PhD in that, and then he moved to London. He'd met his girlfriend using a dating site. He seemed very normal. He was a quiet and private guy, seemed pretty normal, didn't have a lot of friends, so he's kind of introverted, but he's described as being like the ideal tenant by all the other neighbors, didn't really cause any problems, and just kind of described at home as shy and steady and calm. But when they talked to his London co-workers from When I talked to his London co-workers, he was described as being very outgoing. So there's this odd inconsistency with how he portrayed himself. He used the internet a lot for work and for keeping in contact with his girlfriend. Yeah. So on Friday, December 17th, Greg was going to be leaving for the weekend to spend some time with his family in Sheffield, which is like 3 hours north. And he was going to be using Joanna's car. So he went from his work to stop by her work, say goodbye, and let her know he was heading out. On his walk home, he grabbed some food. And then when he got home, because it was so cold, he had a hard time starting the car. So he asked the landlord, Mr. Jeffries, to help him start up his car. They got it started up, no problem. And he headed up there and got up there safe. So after work that day, Joanna was going to be going with coworkers to a nearby pub for a Christmas party. And she didn't end up staying very long. She left around 8 p.m. and we see that on the security footage from the bar. And her friend said that she wasn't very drunk at all either. And you can tell too from the way she's walking and stuff. So she was wearing blue jeans, boots, a pink cotton shirt, a like puffy winter coat. And she had a blue backpack, like for like a school bag with her. She had about like a 20-30 minute walk home, but she did make a couple stops at grocery stores along the way, just kind of looking for whatever she wanted for dinner that night. And so she was caught on camera in the first store at around 8:10, but didn't get anything. She was in the second store around 8:24, and she decided to buy a bottle of cider. And then like she walked away from the cooler and then was like, oh, wait, let me grab another one. And then went back for the second one. And then at the third store at around 8:40, she bought what looked to be like a frozen pizza or maybe like a fresh made pizza, but you have to cook it still. And from that point, she is estimated to have maybe a 10 more minute walk home. So she's supposed to get home around 8:50, which checks out because then we saw her for the last time on a CCTV footage from a pub that she passed just nearby her house. So in the building that night that we know of, we have Joanna alone in her apartment, Vincent alone in his apartment next door to her, and Jeffrey's alone in his apartment above her. So once her boyfriend, Greg, had gotten up there that night, he texted her about the car problems, but said everything was fine and asked how if she had had a good time at the party and stuff. And he didn't get a response from that. On Saturday, the 18th, he tried calling Joanna around lunch and dinner time, but there was no answer. And then on Sunday, the 19th, he was coming home around 8 p.m. And when he gets in, he notices that the front hall area by the door is a bit of a mess, you know, just like coats and bags not hanging like they're supposed to be. So he thought maybe she was just really enjoying her relaxing weekend. That's what she was supposed to be doing, just hanging out at home. They have a cat, so she was just going to be chilling out. So he figured, you know, maybe she just enjoyed her weekend and hadn't gotten around to cleaning up yet.
Or maybe she got home drunk and just like threw her coat everywhere.
Exactly. Maybe that's what happened. And then he thought maybe too, because he saw her coat, he thought maybe she just rushed out really quick to go meet up with some friends or something and had just thrown on a few layers rather than a coat because she wasn't going very far. So he's looking around the apartment and she's not there. And the cat seems hungry, like it hasn't been taken care of. And he notices too that the trash hasn't been added to since he left, which maybe not super weird considering there was only one person at home, but still odd.
Yeah. And I feel like at this point, he was gone for like a day and a half. And there should be something, at least like a napkin that she used if she ate, like literally anything, maybe a cup, anything. So exactly. I feel like it is pretty odd that there's nothing in the trash.
Exactly. What he does notice is there is the bottle of cider on the counter, and it's been opened and it looks like it's got maybe a sip missing. And it's noted that this isn't very odd because she's known for just opening drinks and, you know, just kind of leaving them half finished around. So he just finishes the cider, figures maybe she'll be home soon, and he starts to make some food for himself. So like I said, he got home around 8, and after about an hour, he's starting to get really concerned. Like, this is just odd. Where is she? It's 9 o'clock on a Sunday. They've got work tomorrow. And he's continuing to straighten up, and he's noticed that her coat is there. And then he notices her boots are there. So he decides to call her cell phone, and the cell phone starts ringing in her coat. Obviously, he starts to freak out. So he's calling his friends, he's calling her friends. And by 12:30, he gets to calling her parents. 12:30 in the morning, kind of on Monday morning, he calls her parents. And they obviously don't know where she is. So it's like 9 minutes later, he's calling the police to report her missing.
I'm actually really glad that he acted so quickly, because some people just naturally want to like go out and search for their family member instead of like calling the police right away. And I feel like there's no right or wrong way, because you never really know how you're going to react to a situation like this. But I'm like really glad he called right away.
Yeah, me too. And what I'm really glad about as well is that the next day, you know, well, technically that day, since he called the cops at like 12:40 in the morning, they immediately jump into investigating, because this woman, there's no reason for her to have gone missing. It's not like she ran away or something. She has a healthy relationship, a happy, healthy relationship. She has a good, steady job. There's no money issues. There's no history of mental health issues, nothing like that. And again, her coat is there with her phone. Her boots are there. Her bag is there with her glasses, her keys, her wallet, like anything she would have needed to go anywhere is in the house. So she really just gone.
Yeah. And those are all definitely signs, like he for sure knows, like you said, he wouldn't leave with any of those, especially it's December. She wouldn't leave without her coat, her phone, her keys, like nothing. So it's pretty obvious something alarming is going on.
So her parents also come down to try and help see if they can recognize any clues. And her mom notices that the receipt for buying the pizza is there, but the pizza and the pizza box are nowhere to be seen. They're not in the apartment. So we know that she got home. All her stuff is there. She was able to open up a bottle of cider. But now, weirdly, there's a pizza missing. But we know that the pizza got there, you know? Very odd. The police get the landlord involved, and he immediately is helpful and gives them keys to anything, you know, things like that. And his alibi that night is not very great. It's he was home alone reading.
I feel like it's odd because like nowadays, like who would do that? But for a person that you described, like he was so intellectual, he was a very educated man. Like for him, obviously it was normal, but for everyone else, it's just like, oh, like that's weird for someone to do on a Saturday night.
Yeah, exactly. And the police aren't super thrilled with it because it's not, you can't corroborate that. That's not very strong. So the police are checking with all the residents, and Vincent's girlfriend is super concerned. She's, oh my gosh, how can I help? You know, just caught up in the horror of it like everyone else. Vincent, on the other hand, is very reserved and calm and rational about his answers and things, and his statement is that he didn't even know her. And from what I could figure, everyone was in that building together, like those three parties of people, for at least a year. So I mean, you know, maybe you don't know all your neighbors, but if you share a wall with someone, I feel like you might have at least waved hello to them at some point.
Yeah, I was going to say they didn't necessarily have to be friends, but I'm sure at least in passing, he knew her or like saw her outside or something. Like it's weird of him to say that like he didn't know her at all.
Very odd. So Jeffrey's complete alibi was that he had gotten home around 9 p.m. from the gym and then just went straight to his apartment and spent the whole night up there. Joanna's parents and her boyfriend, they did two press conferences, you know, asking the public for help and making a statement to Joanna in case maybe she's watching, things like that. On December 24th, the police were talking to different people in the neighborhood and getting tips and information in from the public. A few people who had been attending a party nearby that night recalled hearing a woman scream coming from that direction. And another thing that was noted about her apartment, number one, there was no forced entry. And number two was that she had like an advent calendar, you know, where you can like open up for chocolates. It had stopped being opened on the night of the 16th. Just an interesting thing.
I want to point out, you said there was no forced entry, so I feel like it's safe to assume that she like either let them in, or she maybe accidentally left the door unlocked and someone walked in, or like she stepped out. But I feel like it's very important to the fact that there was no forced entry, so it wasn't like a robbery or a break-in, like it was something beyond that.
Yeah. So the boyfriend was ruled out very quickly. His alibi was strong. He was 3 hours north the entire weekend. His whole family was there. And he was very clearly concerned and kept trying to get in contact with his girlfriend. So we're at Christmas Eve, and there's still no clue of what happened. It's just speculations. Christmas morning, a couple was walking their dog around 9 a.m. on Longwood Lane, and they noticed a mound in the snow and what appeared to be clothing peeking out. So they called the police immediately. So this is about 3 miles away from our apartment. And along the lane, there's a decent amount of greenery, like bushes and grass and trees. So there's leaves that have fallen and things like that. And then over the course of these last 8 days, it had snowed a lot too. So there was a fresh blanket of snow. And so we've got a road, and then there's this greenery on the side, right? So that goes back maybe like 5 or 6 feet. And then there's a stone wall that's about 4 or 5 feet tall. On the other side of that is a few more feet of like grass and then a drop off into the quarry. So they notice this mound, they call the police, and this mound obviously ends up being a body. And the body is placed against the wall. And they say placed because her knees were bent as if someone had been like carrying her and set her down. And she was kind of like covered in a bit of leaves. And then because it had snowed, she was covered in snow as well. She was wearing the pink shirt and the jeans that we had seen in the CCTV footage. And we knew that she wasn't wearing her shoes because the boots were in the house, but she was only wearing one sock. But the bottoms of her feet were totally clear of debris, and the foot without a sock, like there was no scratches or anything like that. So she clearly didn't walk there. As they're like examining the site, they realize that there's a splotch of blood, like halfway up this wall. And it's determined that it wasn't from blood splatter. It was rather something that was like soaked in blood, came in contact with it. And so what they kind of deduced from this was that whoever placed her body there had tried at first to like lift her over the wall and just couldn't, like just couldn't do it. So that's why they put her down and tried to cover her in leaves.
Not that I'm thankful that he didn't make it, but like I feel like it would have been so much harder to find her body if she would have been thrown over the wall. Because like obviously in the side of the road, it was so easy for the couple to find her, but like who knows when they would have found her if she was thrown into like this hill or whatever.
Exactly. It was already hard to see her. Drivers couldn't see her from the side of the road. So, yeah, if she had been on the other side of that wall, who knows how long. You're right. So, it's important to note that her jeans were like totally fine. They weren't unbuttoned, they weren't removed. And her shirt was kind of raised above her right breast, but her bra was in place. So to me, that means that her shirt just got shuffled during movement, not that there was something sexual related to the incident. And there was no like fluids or anything on her clothing, you know? But everyone was just completely in shock. Like, this is Christmas morning. This is not what we wanted, you know? This is just tragic. So it just really kind of lit a fire under everyone, and they knew like we have to find who did this. So one thing that I thought was really interesting was the lead investigator decided not to place a tent around her body during the investigating of that site because it could have warmed up and melted away any evidence on her or in the snow around her. So on December 26th, the police were able to like infer that this was Joanna Yates, but because her body was so frozen, the post-mortem examination would take longer to complete. So by the 28th, they were able to reveal that, yes, this is Joanna Yates, and her cause of death was strangulation. Manual strangulation, meaning that someone used one or both of their hands to strangle her.
You know, when you said that they had found her, my initial thought was that she died of like hypothermia or something, that died like out in the cold. But obviously she was placed outside after she was strangled.
Yeah, she was. And she had sustained 43 injuries to her body. Now, I wasn't able to find the autopsy report, but what I was able to figure out from different news articles and things was they were more defensive type wounds because her nose was broken and it was a lot of like scratches and bruises, things of that nature. They were able to find that there was some DNA on the backs of her knees, confirming that she had been like carried there, you know? And they did take swabs of places where her skin was bare, and they did find some evidence of foreign DNA. So at this point, they're asking, you know, who killed her? Who took her out to Longwood Lane? And is this the same person? Is it a group of people? What they were able to narrow down was that this is a person that she knew, that she was comfortable enough with to let them into her apartment. They knew that she was home alone that night, and they had access to a vehicle. From that, the landlord is suspect number one.
Poor guy. He was just trying to read some books.
He's just trying to read books. And he's pinned as number one. So his alibi, it wasn't great. He has keys to the entire building. And he definitely knew that Greg was gone that night because he helped him start up the car that evening.
So he perfectly fits the criteria that you said.
Exactly.
And, like, he has access to the building because he's a landlord. Like, he literally fits everything.
Yeah. So he ended up giving two statements during the investigation. So the initial one where he's like, I got home from 9 p.m. from the gym and I went up straight to my room. But a few days after that, he had remembered that when he got home that night, when he was like pulling his car into the driveway, he noticed on one of those side paths that there was like a person or a group of people kind of walking down that path away from him. But it was just so unimportant that it didn't even, you know, register to him that night that it could have been anything. But when the cops heard this, all they heard was a man adding something to his story after the fact, rather than his intention being good and just trying to help the investigation. So at the same time, the reporters have been hanging around the house, and one reporter overheard her rival talking about Jeffries and suggesting that he was the culprit, because the police didn't release to the public that he was like their suspect. Just to them, they knew. So this rival is suggesting that Jeffries is the culprit, and at the same time, Jeffries is leaving his building to go get groceries in his car. So these reporters just swarm him and are like, give us a statement, like, did you do it, did you kill her? And he was being very polite, but he was making it clear that he wasn't going to make a comment. He said, quote, everything I've said to the police, and I'm not prepared to make any comments to the media, end quote. But he said that night he felt trapped in his apartment because the media was, they were still outside and they were calling him, asking for statements all night.
And I'm sure he didn't have bad intentions, but I feel like when someone declines to speak, especially to the media, like, it just looks bad.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like if someone said, I already said what I had to say, or like, I don't have a statement at this time, people just immediately jump like, oh, he did it, or he's guilty, that's why he doesn't want to talk. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that also added to the fact that they were like on him the whole time.
Yeah, I agree with you. December 30th, Jeffries was arrested in the morning. He literally woke up to the cops pounding on his door, and he was completely caught off guard. He had no idea that he was a suspect or anything. And so he asked if he could make a phone call before he left. And the officer obviously said, No, just get dressed. You can make a call when you get there. So they take him down to the station and he's able to make his phone call. And his friend Clive is who he ended up calling. And then Clive ends up talking to one of his friends later on in the day. And his friend is a lawyer in London. And they're talking about the case. And Clive is just kind of trying to brush it off in the sense that, like, he doesn't think that it's a big deal. And he's like, oh, you know, they'll realize that Jeffries is a good guy. It's going to be okay. And the lawyer says, I'm going to call you back in 10 minutes and hangs up. Clive's like, okay. So he calls him back exactly 10 minutes later with the information about where Jeffries is being detained, the contact information for the desk sergeant, and instructions to call the police and tell them that there was legal representation coming from London in 3 hours.
Oh, shoot. It's getting serious. It's
very serious. The police say they didn't release his name to the media or to the public at all, but what they do release is his age. And that was enough for the media to figure out that it was the landlord, because we have a 33-year-old man, a 27-year-old man, and a 65-year-old man. So at this point, Vincent is the neighbor. Vincent is in Holland with his family for the holidays, and he's watching footage on the news of Jeffries being arrested and calls the police. He tells them he remembers seeing Jeffrey's car facing the apartment building that night, but then the following morning when he left to go pick up his girlfriend, that the car was facing the road rather than the house. So he's implying that Jeffries drove his vehicle that night on Joanna's murder. So when the police hear this, they send an officer out to Holland to talk to him and investigate this further. They met at a hotel near the airport, and along the way, he kept asking questions to the officer about the investigation, and the detective said he was overly interested in the details of the forensic examinations about her apartment. So it's striking everyone as odd. Like, why are you so interested in this specific aspect? So upon recounting the events of that evening, his statement changes. He ends up telling the officer that he went out twice that night, when in his initial statement, he said that he was at home until he left that morning to go get his girlfriend. So the officer asked him for a DNA sample and fingerprints to rule them out if they found them in the apartment. And he was really reluctant, but he eventually gave in and gave them willingly. But this was enough for the officer to be suspicious. So she called ahead and reported that to the police back in London. So on December 31st, the police are granted more time to keep questioning Jeffries. They eventually let him go after taking a lot of his possessions and evidence, like a lot of his books. And that one I really didn't understand. Like, I get tirelessly searching the car that they got the tip about, but what are you going to get from his books?
I guess proof that he was reading them.
I guess. The police decide that they are going to go ahead and question Vincent because of that suspicious phone call. And the officer was said to have said, quote, it wasn't quite right, end quote, the way that he was acting about not wanting to give the sample and asking questions. And Jeffries thought that the police were making another mistake. He was like, there's no way it's Vincent. He's the ideal tenant. This is ridiculous. They're doing it again. And at the same time, the media had taken off dragging the landlord's name through the mud. It was all over the news and in the front pages. And they were calling him things like lewd, creepy, loner, a peeping Tom. One of the reporters said, quote, I hate to say this, but he was suspicious because of the way he looked and behaved at the time, end quote. So the media is continuing to vilify him even after his DNA's results had come in and even after all that questioning had eliminated him as a suspect.
That's so sad. He was clearly, like, in a sense, and cleared by the police, and people are still, like, dragging him.
Mm-hmm.
That's so sad. I can't even imagine how he was feeling.
Yeah. And now, I mean, he's released from police custody and questioning, but he has to go back to living in that apartment building. So thankfully, his friend Clive, who had gotten the lawyer, offered for him to stay with him, And he said that he kept trying to shield Jeffries away from all the nasty stuff in the news and just giving him the general information. And Clive said that he felt hunted and watched the entire time in his house, trying to give his friend a safe place to stay. So let's take a look at what Vincent was doing on the night of the murder. So we have that first statement where he says, "I don't know her. I was home all night until I left to go get my girlfriend. That's it." Then we get in the second statement that he left the house twice that night. He did. And he was caught on CCTV footage going to a store that he had to drive to. And that's important because we have Greg being able to stop and walk on his way home getting food. We have then Joanna being able to stop at three different grocery stores on her way home. So why?
And all within a walking distance also.
Exactly. So why do you need to drive all the way to a different, like go to a store that you need to drive to? Maybe you need to get something special. No. What did he get from the store? Beer, chips, and rock salt.
Rock salt.
Rock salt.
Not even like something to eat. He got rock salt. Beer, well, aside from the beer and chips.
Yep.
That's weird.
Very nutritious. While he's at the store, knowing that he was a people flow analyst or public flow analyst, I forget the term, and he knew about like security cameras, he's walking in like the direct middle of every single frame of the security cameras in this store. And at one point pulls out his phone in front of the camera to text his girlfriend that something to the effect of, "It's so boring here without you. I hope you're having a good time," things like that.
I feel like the fact that he did it was kind of just to like mark a presence, like, "Hey, make sure I'm here. Make sure you can see me wide open." Like there's just evidence that he's there at the store.
Yeah, he's being very methodical about his movements and putting a lot of intent behind them. So we find out later on from some of his friends that during this time of the investigation, before he's a suspect, he was actually talking about it a lot to his friends and coworkers and kind of playing himself as the victim, that he was suffering because he was so concerned and Tanya was so concerned. So he was suffering that way too. And at one point he was at a dinner party with some friends and some of the females that he was friends with there were nervous about walking home because of Joanna's murder. And so he walked them home.
Little did they know. That's so messed up.
Mm-hmm. He even went to work the Monday after her murder. She was murdered on Friday. He went to work Monday. And when he was at work, he was talking about the disappearance too. He's like, "Oh, did you hear? Like, my neighbor is missing. Have you been hearing that Joanna's missing?" Yeah. And he went with his girlfriend to visit her parents for Christmas. And then he drove out of the country to go spend New Year's in Holland with his family. So on January 2nd, Vincent is ID'd to the public as suspect number one. And one newscaster said she hadn't even heard the name before and that it was, quote, "very unexpected," end quote. So I just want to make a note that they had taken his DNA sample on December 30th, and it does take anywhere from 2 to 10 days for results to come back. So that's why he couldn't be named exactly right away. The DNA that they found on her was eroded a lot by salt. So they weren't able to determine where the sample had come from on the person, whether it had been blood, semen, spit, anything like that. They were able to say that there was only a 1 in 1 million chance that it wasn't Vincent.
So it was literally like 99.99999% that it was him.
Right. So it's definitely his, but it's been eroded so much that they can't identify where it came from on him, but it's definitely him and it's on her.
So he definitely used a rock salt for this, right?
Correct. So what they figured out was Remember how Jeffries had seen people in, or a person? He couldn't even figure out if it was one person or multiple people, but he had seen someone on that side path when he got home that night.
Yeah.
Vincent took the salt and sprinkled it onto the ground and must have placed Joanna's body there before, like, moving his car in or something. I'm not entirely sure why he needed to place her outside and then put her in the car, but he had placed her on the bed of salt, and that's why the DNA evidence had been eroded.
I wonder if he also did this to, like, not leave Joanna's DNA on the sidewalk since it was so nearby their home. But
that's what I would think.
That just goes to show us that he knew what he was doing. If he went out to the store to specifically buy rock salt and then very strategically used it during the murder and after the murder, like, this man knew what he was doing.
Yeah, I'm with you. So they get his car and they're able to find a very small trace of blood in the trunk. The lady said she couldn't remember if it came from one of the side panels or it was from the trim, but it was a very small amount. And it was an exact match for Joanna. He's still not saying much, and that he's just kind of sticking to the story of, well, I didn't really know her. And meanwhile, his family in Holland thinks that he's completely innocent because of how he acts at home. And he sent that text to his girlfriend. Mind you, he sent that text and went to the store while Joanna was dead.
Damn. So at this point, do we know if the murder happened in her apartment? Like, he just left her in her apartment dead and then went to the store?
We really don't know, because
maybe it's hard to tell.
It's hard to tell, yes. There wasn't a lot of blood from her body, you know, except for that little bit we talked about on the wall. And again, those were more defensive wounds. And I couldn't find the autopsy report, but I'm assuming a lot of that blood probably came from when her nose was broken. So there, if it happened in her apartment, I'm sure he was able to clean up what little bit got around.
Yeah. But just the fact that he left her dead wherever it was, went to the store, texted his girlfriend after he just killed someone, like, that's insane.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a very small window of opportunity here, because we know that Joanna got home around 8:50 and Jeffries got home around 9, and he didn't report hearing any screaming.
So it happened between those 5 to 10 minutes?
Within, you know, give or take, yeah. It had to
have. Holy cow.
If, you know, because we saw her on that CCTV footage at like 8:50 and she was very close to her house. And then Jeffrey says he got home at around 9 o'clock. So, you know, I'm sure there's some leeway, but yeah, within that time frame.
We also have to take into account that it doesn't take 5 seconds for someone to die by strangulation. It literally takes minutes. Like, you have to choke someone for, I want to say, like, 5 to 8 minutes for them to die. Maybe less, maybe more. I don't know. But it takes a while for them to die.
Mm-hmm.
So not only did Joanna fight for a long time, but this man was also choking her for a really long time.
So on January 20th, Vincent Tabak was arrested on the suspicion of murdering Joanna Yates. He ends up being questioned for 96 hours, and this is when they take his car into custody to search for it, or search it for evidence. And the evidence that they found was very minimal in, like, the grand scheme of things, but it was enough. So they found some fibers and blood in the trunk of his car. The blood matched Joanna's DNA, and they were able to figure out that the fibers in his trunk came from her bed sheets. Important to note at this point too, like we mentioned earlier, he had driven this car out of the country to go spend New Year's in Holland. So he might've cleaned this car by now. He's driven it out of the country. Who knows? And the fact that they're still able to find this evidence is just miraculous. Yeah. So then they examine his coat and they find one single fiber from her shirt on his coat. On January 22nd, the police charged Vincent with Joanna Yates' murder. On 24th of January, he's taken to court and he's immediately taken to the prison. And one of the officers who was there during his intake, says he couldn't figure out if Vincent was like nervous and dealt with it by grinning or if he found everything like amusing, but he seemed completely lost. Like it was just all very, very odd, his behavior.
Maybe not the typical like murder, I just killed someone type of behavior.
Right. On May 5th, while he's in custody, he tells the prison chaplain that he's going to plead guilty to killing Joanna, but not murder. When they're looking at his work laptop and his personal laptop, they find that he was searching the distinction between murder and manslaughter.
I'm thinking if he was like planning what he could get away with, maybe, or like already pre-planning his trial.
This was searches after she was dead. Far as I could tell, it seemed like they were after she was dead.
So then he was preparing himself for like the trial because he probably knew he was going to get caught either
right.
way.
Because I think beforehand, he probably figured he wasn't going to get caught.
True.
You know?
I would hope like a murderer can only hope. I don't know.
So he was going to claim that he accidentally killed Joanna. Mind you, he's like a foot taller than her and a lot bigger than her. We have a 25-year-old 5'5" woman and a 33-year-old 6'4" man. So the trial begins on October 4th, and his defense is this. He says that when he got home that night, he saw her through her kitchen window and that he waved at her, and then she beckoned him in. Just think about that in your head, the difference between a wave, hello, and a beckon. So he's claiming that he says hi and then she beckons him inside.
Very different motions. I'm like doing it right now. Like, first of all, if you say hi to someone, your hand is facing like outwards. If you're inviting them in, you're literally doing like a scooping in motion. Like very different and very hard to mistake.
And this is after he's also said, oh, no, I didn't know her. I didn't know her that well. He knew her well enough for her to beckon you inside after you only said hello.
So he's not only lying about not going out, but now he's contradicting himself.
So he says that they chatted in her kitchen for maybe 10 or 15 minutes and that she had made a flirtatious comment and then he tried to kiss her. So he says she started to scream to stop him and he put his hand over his mouth, over her mouth to stop her from screaming. And when he removed it, she started screaming again. And he says that's when he accidentally strangled her. He claimed that he had only panicked and didn't mean to kill her.
So is he like saying that this 20-second strangulation killed her? How can he justify that?
Exactly.
What a smart man.
Yeah. So this was his defense, that he accidentally killed her. So he's claiming manslaughter. The prosecution, however, or the state, you know, who's suing him for her death, wants to prove that this was murder. So the difference between murder and manslaughter is that with manslaughter, it's an unlawful or reckless act that causes death, versus murder is the intent to kill or cause seriously bodily harm at the time of death. And the prosecution was kind of worried that they didn't have a strong enough case. I don't know why they were worried, because in my eyes, this is pretty strong.
Yeah, I feel like it's more than clear that it was murder.
So it did take the jury a little while to deliberate, but when they came back, there were no empty seats. It was, you know, his family, her family, but a lot of it was the news outlets filling up the room. The jury rejected the defense and found him guilty of murder. They gave him life without parole and a mandatory minimum of 20 years. It's murder, not manslaughter. There was nothing ambiguous about his actions and his involvement in her murder.
Good. I'm glad he didn't get his way.
Mm-hmm. My favorite part of this is on July 29th of 2011, Christopher Jeffries, the landlord, he sued 8 national newspapers for libel and he won. And I'm very happy.
Yes, sir. Get your bag. Yes. Honestly, I love that for him because they dragged his name. They slandered him to the ground.
They called him a peeping Tom and stuff. Like, that's just awful.
Yeah, this poor 65-year-old man. Yeah, good for him.
Yes. So like we did mention earlier, the police believe that this was a serial killer in the making. Vincent's actions were very systematic. He was planned. He was emotionally detached. And it's just very, it's unusual. So his actions just show that it's possible that this was a serial killer in the making. And it's miraculous that he was caught and stopped.
Looking back now, like, the rock salt was very planned. The fact that he purposely made himself like be seen on the cameras in the grocery store, like, there's just so many things that he probably thought would cover him or like he would get away with, but like, I don't know, I guess he planned for himself enough, but then it didn't work out. Either way, I agree, he was a serial killer in the making.
Definitely. The big takeaway for this story or this case isn't necessarily about, you know, keeping ourselves or our friends and family safe. For me, the takeaway in this story is the media. It's very important that you're doing your research on your own and making sure that you're getting both sides of the story. Whether you agree with both sides or not, it's important to know everything that's being said out there, because the media, within reason, is able to create their own narration of what's going on. And if you notice, a lot of the news sources will, and it doesn't matter if it's political, financial, celebrity, any news source, whenever there's a story, they tend to piggyback off of one another and continue to regurgitate the same facts and the same perspective. So it's just important to pay attention to what you're ingesting.
I think it's also safe to say that sometimes the media picks and chooses what they like publish. So like in this story, we see that the media portrayed this man, the landlord, as like the number one suspect, when the police hadn't even identified as a suspect. Like, they did it way before the police thought that he was even a suspect.
And so, continued to do so after he was proven to be innocent. Cleared. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think not only did they pick and choose, but they continue to give people like the wrong information after it was proven that he was innocent. So that's very much seen these days too as well.
So it's always just something important to keep in the back of your mind.
So that's all we have for today's episode on Joanna Yates. Thank you all again so much for tuning in, and we hope to see you all during our next episode, which will be on December 30th.
As always, if you haven't already, make sure you follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at Real Time Crime, and we'll see you in the next episode.